welcome to episode 73 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name's David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How are you going, Perry? You haven't been eating too many chocolate Easter eggs, have you?
Hello, David. I've been eating a few. I have got to temper my appetites in that regard. We're not really big on Easter eggs as much as we used to be. It's just a few around
the place. It's for kids, just, really, isn't it? Really?
It's just to give you the feeling of that time year at this time. So, but yeah. You just got to be a bit careful. You know, a couple of the small little ones, you know, the quail egg size ones,
yeah.
a couple of those a day, and, you know, that's not too bad. But if I think if I start getting stuck into it, I'll,
We're not a pretty sight. We're keeping ourselves very much under control.
Absolutely.
By the way, Perry, this is our third anniversary episode. Oof. We've been doing this for 3 years, which is pretty amazing.
My God, I hadn't realised it was that.
That's 3 years. 73 episodes, almost 84 hours in total, I added them up, which means you could listen to us and our friends talk for 3.5 days without a break.
Luxury.
No, you wouldn't want to.
Anyway. Why not? Yeah. Anyway, that sounds good.
All right.
Bit of a shock, that.
Yeah, indeed. There we are. All right, well, we'll roll on. Do you want to talk about the Hugos?
I shall talk about some the Hugos and some other award news, David. I think I might have mentioned last time that the Hugo Award ballot was imminent. Well, yes, it has now been released by this year's Worldcon, and that is now available. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. The winners of the awards are going to be announced in Chicago at ShyCon 8 in early September this year. The convention runs from the 31st of August for 5 days in Chicago. It is my intention to be there. Whether I'm at the Hugo Awards, I'm not sure. We'll probably try and attempt to get there, but I'll certainly be reading everything, and we'll talk a bit more about that and what we intend to do regarding reading the finalists on the ballot a bit later on. Now, just a few brief notes about the Hugo Award, because there's some interesting things this particular year. In the novel category, mostly they're expected nominees, but includes the first ever best novel nominee by an Australian. She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan, which I believe you have read, David.
I have read. It's excellent, yes.
Oh, my God. Here's a man who basically doesn't read a lot of this stuff, and suddenly he's way in front of everybody else and has read it.
Very unusual.
Well, that's good. It sort of saves you the problem of having to try to catch up a little bit later on in the year. So we shall definitely be talking about that particular book later on. In the novella category, mostly as expected, although there is one notable omission, that is Martha Wells, but I will discuss that a bit later on as well. Moving on, I'm not going to cover all the categories, just purely the ones when I want to sort of have a look at a higher level at this point. The best related work category, which is really, well, as it says, related work to the genre, so mostly non-fiction, because fiction's covered for everything else. This year we have an Australian nominee, in fact, a Melbourne nominee, Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, Radical Science Fiction 1950 to 1985, edited by Andrew Nettie and Ian McIntyre, which is pretty good. The Nova Mob discussion earlier this month was about that particular book, and Ian McIntyre did a very, very good job of not letting us know that he was on the ballot, because, of course, he had already been informed that that was the case while he was giving the talk. So he was obviously a happy man. In the Best Editor Short Form category, Jonathan Strawn from Western Australia. He's been nominated quite often in this. I don't believe that he's ever won it, but frankly, I think it's probably time that he did win it, because he's done some damn good stuff over the years. In the Best Fan Cast category, in which we were eligible, David.
But not very likely to be nominated.
But we didn't get on. We didn't get on the list. So the Australian one on the list was the Cood Street Podcast, edited, produced by Jonathan Strawn and Gary K. Wolfe. Jonathan Strawn, as I mentioned, is a West Australian science fiction editor, and Gary K. Wolfe is a reviewer for Locus magazine, and they've been doing that for I don't know, it seems like forever. There are well over 500 episodes, and they won the Hugo Award last year, Just to Fly, I believe, suitably. I thought that was an excellent choice last year. It's one of the ones that I listen to on a regular basis and always enjoy. And also, on the Hugo Awards ballot, but not a Hugo Award, because there are a couple of these, we have the astounding award for Best New Writer, Shelley Parker Chan. This used to be called the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, which was sponsored by Astounding Magazine or Analog. They've now decided to change the name after a bit of a ruckus a couple of years ago. We won't go back over that. But anyway, it's now called the Astounding Award for Best New Writer, and everybody's pretty happy about the name change, so that's good. So good luck to Shelley with that one.
Indeed.
Also announced is the 2022 Philip K. Dick Award, and this is awarded to the best original paperback published in the USA each year and sponsored by the Philadelphia Science Fiction Society. The winner this year is Dead Space by Carly Wallace, Kelly Wallace, and special citation to The Escapement by Lavi Tidar. I know of Tidar, I don't know of Wallace. I'd better read that book. The Compton Cook Award, there's more and more of these awards, is awarded to the best English language first novel of the year in any of the SF fantasy or horror genres by members of the Baltimore Science Fiction Society. This was won this year by A Master of Gin by P. Dejelly Clark, and that particular book is on this year's Hugo Award ballot as a finalist. So that's interesting. Carrying on. Still got a couple more to go. The 2022 Australian Shadows Award winners. These are awarded by the Australian Horror Writers Association. Horror is not something we cover terribly often on this particular podcast, although I keep on putting as a list every year that on my to-do list every year that I've got to read half a dozen. I never seem to get there because there always seems to be so much else that I'm sort of looking at, but I really should do a bit more of this. And I'll give you the major winners for this award. Best novel was won by The Girls Left Behind by J.P. Townley. Long fiction was Ariadne, I Love You by J. Ashley Smith. Short fiction, A Good Big Brother by Matt Tye. Collected works, Tool Tales by Karen Warren. And non-fiction, I'm Looking Right at You, H.P. Lovecraft by Jack Dann. Right. One more, David, one more to go. The British Science Fiction Association Awards, BSFA Awards, were announced at the British EasterCon over this past weekend. The two major winners at the top were for the best novel, Shards of Earth by Adrian Tchaikovsky, not nominated for either the Hugo or Nebula Awards, oddly, but Adrian Tchaikovsky is an excellent writer. And the best shorter fiction went to a novella, Fireheart Tiger by Elliot de Bodard. And Fireheart Tiger is nominated, or has been nominated, and on the final ballot for both the Hugo and Nebulas. And I will be mentioning that a bit later, but not discussing it today, but mentioning it, and I'll explain why when we get down to that particular part of the program. I think we're done with that lot, David, which is probably a good thing.
Indeed.
Probably enough awards for a time being.
Enough awards, that's for sure. Now I have some sad news. We're very sorry to note the death of our friend, long-time SF fan Christine Ashby. Christine was one of the first fans about my age that I came across when I sort of got into fandom, because she'd been at university with Kerry Hanfield, who was my friend from school. And together they were in the Monash University Science Fiction Association. I think John Foyster was in there too, in that association at the time. She was someone who I was always impressed by. She dealt with her, she had a disability, which she dealt with great courage. And she had a sharp wit, fierce intelligence, and she was always pleasant company. I greatly valued her friendship over the years. Now, Christine was involved in organising and running several Melbourne SF conventions in the 1970s and 80s. She was the guest of honour at QCon in Brisbane in 1973, and she was the Duff winner, the Down Under Fan Fund winner, in 1976, which sent her on a trip to the United States to attend the Worldcon that year. Christine was also the treasurer of both the first AussieCon and AussieCon 2. And I have to admit that she and her husband, Derek, were the real workhorses of organising that convention. I was merely the chairman. They did a heck of a lot of the work to get it running. And outside of fandom, Christine served for several years on the board of the Paraplegic and Quadriplegic Association of Victoria. And for a short while, she was its chairperson. So we're very sorry to see her go. But it's sad. So our sincere sympathies to husband Derek for her loss.
Yes, I knew Christine a bit in the 70s and 80s as well. She faded out of fandom after about 1985. I think she'd basically been a bit worn out by that stage. But I do remember that she contacted me on the day before the 1999 Worldcon was about to start and wished me well. And I was very, very grateful for that little message that she sent to me. It was came out of the blue, and I was really appreciative that somebody was thinking of me as I was diving headfirst into a vat of something or other. I don't know what it was, but I was diving headfirst. But yes, but as you say, she was always she's always a witty, intelligent company. And yes, my thoughts go to Derek as well in this time, and I hope things are going okay for him.
Indeed. Well, let's go on to talking about what we've been reading lately. I think I'm due to start this off. Just let me have a look. So I'm going to talk about a book called The Last Woman in the World by Inga Simpson. This is an Australian book, Australian author. But unfortunately, I have to start by saying that I was disappointed by it, mostly by the way it comes to an end. But there's some good, effective writing in it. It's and some interesting characters, some well-described scenes, and some quite thrilling moments. But as a whole, it just didn't work for me. So there's going to be several spoilers as I go through this, I'm afraid. So at the most crude description, you could say that this is a post-apocalyptic story with most of humanity wiped out and something not too dissimilar to zombies running around. But that's a pretty crude way of describing it. It's the book's better than that, and it has a very Australian spin to it. But the title, The Last Woman in the World, is a bit of a false promise. Rachel, the protagonist, is far from the last woman in the world, and I suppose you could treat that metaphorically. But even as the book ends, there are still many women and men alive in the world. So what's it about? Well, Rachel is an artist. She's a glass sculptor who lives alone in a remote location in the bush, somewhere in the Great Dividing Range, I think. And she's a long way from her neighbours, but she gets weekly supplies delivered to her. She's pretty much a recluse, apparently due to a number of traumas that she's endured, which we discover slowly throughout the book. And as the book opens, her usual supplies, the person who usually brings her supplies, hasn't turned up on time. And although she's puzzled by this and a bit worried, she isn't yet really totally concerned. But late at night, as she sits by her fireside, there's a knock on the door. And that shouldn't be possible because her house is surrounded by a high stone wall and locked gates. Nevertheless, the knocking continues and a woman's voice pleads to be let in. She has a baby with her, and Rachel eventually, very reluctantly, opens the door. The woman, Hannah, tells her there's been an incredibly fast-moving plague of some sort which has literally killed off most of humanity within a few days. Rachel never watches television or listens to the news, so this is why she's ignorant of this. We ultimately learn that this plague doesn't seem to be of a virus or a bacteria, but some sort of psychic influence, perhaps of an alien visitation. It's never quite clear. Hannah's baby, it turns out, is very sick, and Rachel eventually decides to leave her compound and travel with Hannah and the child on foot over the mountain to try to reach Rachel's sister, a doctor, who practices in a town on the other side of the mountain. It seems like a pretty silly decision, really, because surely with all these people dead, there's a lot of abandoned vehicles out there. You should be able to hijack a car and travel in that, but no, they walk over the mountain. And where the book shines is its really loving description of the Australian bush and the wildlife, and its account of the woman's trek is really well done. And then there's also a really well done account later on of a really hair-raising, tension-filled passage through a bushfire. But where the book starts to fall down for me is when the women finally reach Canberra, and we learn that there are still people surviving there. Some kind of antidote to the plague, or them, as the shadowy influences are called, has been developed, so it's something you can be given to stop this influencing you. But even though this has been developed, there are groups of evil-minded militias out there who are trying to destroy supplies of the antidote. They're sort of weaponized anti-vaxxers, I suppose. And not only that, but they're intent on kidnapping babies. Why they need to do that, it's not at all clear, because you know, people can, you know, still make babies pretty readily. Anyway, after defeating one serious assault by the bad guys, Rachel then decides that she's going to go back home, alone, by herself, except for Hannah's baby. You'll have to read the book to find out what happens to Hannah. So with the baby, she finally gets home, reaches her house, which is untouched, and settles down to a happy ending. Now, hang on. Almost all of human civilization has been destroyed. There's obviously not going to be any manufacturing for decades. And she's somehow going to survive comfortably with a baby that she has to feed using formula, with no supplies from the outside world. I don't think so. Anyway, despite all those reservations, the book was worth reading, and I'd be prepared to read others that the author writes. It's interesting, too, that Gary Dish's book we discussed recently, The Way It Is Now, it's one of the first books I read that incorporates and comments on our recent experiences of the pandemic, as well as the devastating bushfires of 2019 to 2020. And it does make a number of good points about our relationship to the natural world. So, yeah, I don't know what I'd score this. I think probably I gave it a 3 out of 5 as a score. But, yeah, interesting.
Do you feel that this is an example of an author that's come in from a literary background and picked up a few science fictional tropes and doesn't really know how to run with them? Or is it an extrapolation of the current or most recent pandemic? Do you think that's...
Yeah, it's partially in reaction to that, but I get the feeling it was written before that, possibly written just after the bushfires happened, which I suppose was just before the pandemic hit, wasn't it? So
yeah,
it's hard to know what the influences were, but yeah, it just doesn't gel for me, this book. That's all. It was well written, and to say that the descriptions of the Australian bush were very loving. And if I remember rightly, she's been involved in a number of conservation programs and so on. She's very dedicated to Australian wildlife and the Australian landscape, and that comes through. That comes through pretty well in the book.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to also talk about an Australian literary novel. This one from 2008. It's called The Spare Room by Helen Garner. Now, Helen Garner is a big name in Australian literary fiction, especially in Melbourne. And this particular book was the winner of the Queensland Premier's Literary Award, the Victorian Premier's Literary Award, and the Barbara Jeffress Award, as well as being shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. This was Garner's first foray back into fiction in around 16 or so years, since her previous work, Cosmo Cosmolino, in 1992. So she took a fair gap away from fiction. She probably felt that she'd probably written everything she needed to. In the interim, she concentrated on script and non-fiction work. And after having read this and realising that that's what she had done, you can actually see that she's actually utilised all that experience that she picked up writing scripts and also non-fiction work into this particular novel. And after I finished talking about it, you could understand that some people might actually consider this not to be a novel, but a sort of piece of personalised reportage, but I'll get to that and explain why. And part of the reason why it comes across as that is that the novel's main character is a writer named Helen, no last name, but a writer named Helen, who's now divorced, which Garner is, and lives in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, which Garner does. And she appears to make a living from her non-fiction writing and reviews, much like Garner does. And so you can start to think, if you know anything at all about the author here, you start to think, this is very much like, the main character is very much like the author. And some people can get that a little bit confused. And I seem to recall that at the time when the reviews of this came out, that some people were saying that it really wasn't a novel. And anyway, so let me just explain what the whole story is so that the writer named Helen is living on her own, yes, as him, in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. She lives next door to her daughter, and her granddaughter is always coming in, and which is quite good for the two of them, because Helen gets a really good relationship with the daughter, because the daughter could just come through a gate in the fence. The mother, her daughter, next Helen's daughter next door, can leave the granddaughter over with the mother very, very easily, and the Helen's not fussed about having the daughter coming in and out at all times of the day. So that all works out really well for them. As the book starts, Helen's been contacted by Nicola, an old friend from Sydney, who is suffering from terminal cancer, has decided to travel to Melbourne to try out a new treatment regime. This is a treatment regime that's a bit on the crystals, moddable, massive doses of vitamin C sort of arrangement. Sort of, yeah, not exactly above board in terms of the medical stuff. But Nicola is in a terminal phase of a cancer. And Nicola's an eternal optimist who's always looking for the new things. She thinks this is absolutely going to fix her. You know, the vitamin C is going to be absolutely wonderful for me, and everything's good. And Helen's sort of, yeah, she's okay with this. Thinks that, yeah, that'll be right. She'll be just down here for a few days. And she does up the spare room for her arrival. And she's vaguely looking forward to Nicola turning up. But she's in for a bit of a shock when she picks her up from the airport, because Nicola is a total mess and really struggles after having flown down from Sydney down to Melbourne, is drained and exhausted, and just basically goes to bed and sleeps all the first night and not really very happy. But after a while, after a couple of days, the relationship between the two sets in, and then Nicola starts heading off to... going in for her treatments, and it soon becomes clear, to Helen at least, that the people that she's seeing are a whole bunch of charlatans who are just trying to rip her off and are really just taking advantage of her in a bad state at the end of her life. So she's really bloody annoyed about this. The treatments are not doing Nicola much good at all, and in fact are making her feel worse. But it's only going to be a little while, says Nicola. No, it's only going to be a little while. Sooner or later, I'm going to feel a lot better. A couple of days, I'll be fit as a mallee bull, as she says. I'll be charging around everywhere. In the meantime, she's basically sweating like a pig overnight. Helen's having to do basically a full-blown nursing job here. And as you can understand, sort of things start getting a little bit... She gets a bit resentful about this, because this wasn't what she thought she was getting herself in for. Nicola does not seem to want to listen to any form of reason about what's going on, and the relationship slowly over a period of time, over a week or so, just starts to fracture a little bit. Helen's trying to do the best she can. She can't have her granddaughter in, because her granddaughter's now picked up a dose of the sniffles, and she can't give that to Nicola because it probably might kill her, because she's got terminal cancer. And so this is a very interesting discussion about how this person, on the one hand, Helen starts off with the best of all intentions, but gets totally worn down by this person that she's coming to care for, who doesn't seem to want to listen to reason. And Helen's sort of view of what she's going through, she feels really bad about the fact that she's angry about what is going on. But it just strikes me as being a perfectly natural expression of frustration that she's feeling, that she suddenly finds herself in a situation where she's having to work pretty much 24 hours a day looking after this woman. She didn't think she was going to have to. She just thought the woman was going to go in and out to hospital, going in and out to these treatment rooms in Collins Street, and that was going to be it. But it's not that way at all. So this is a really, really interesting journey for the two of them that are making. One of them's heading towards death, and one of them is basically trying to maintain their sense of self and not trying to get themselves to be an angry person. But unfortunately, they find themselves falling towards it. Now, this is definitely a Melbourne novel. There's lots of references to things like the Melbourne Loop Railway Station, Flinders Street, Melbourne Loop Railway Line, Flinders Street Station, David Jones Food Hall, Epworth Hospital in Richmond. They talk about going to the waiter's restaurant for dinner, all this sort of stuff. I mean, Helen Garner is very definitely a Melbourne person. But I just think that makes it all part of the background, and it sort of adds a lot more to it. It just, especially if you know what she's talking about and where, what she's dealing with, you get a much broader view of the environment in which this whole story is being set. And actually, at one point in there, I was actually thinking that this, you know, might really be a metaphor that Helen Garner's trying to do about how, you know, Helen's the stoic Melbourne, you know, strong and tough, and Nicola's just jumping all over the place and really enthusiastic and being the Sydney person. And I thought, maybe. No, maybe I'm stretching things.
It sounds a bit too.
I thought, well, I better stay away from the metaphors because I don't really want to get there anyway. Now, I only had a week with my father at the end of his life a couple of years ago. So I didn't have to go through all of this whole process of looking after them from a physical level, you know, basically cleaning up after them after they've been to the toilet, putting them in the shower, changing their clothes, getting them in and out of bed and having continually to wash the bedding and so on. And so if you have been through that in a very deep way, this may be a very, very emotional book to read, because the emotional turmoils of the two main characters are really quite intense all the way right through this. But I think it hits home, and I think it hits home very, very well. And so Garner, with this particular novel, has sort of blurred the lines somewhat between a straight literary novel and a piece of non-fiction or a piece of sort of personal reportage. It's all sort of come together so well, but it's come together just fantastically. I was really blown away by this book. I was really, really impressed with it. I gave it a 4.7 out of 5. And I reckon I'm going to struggle to read a better book this particular year. So I'd really heartily recommend this book to everybody, but be aware that it is a rather, it's emotional and at a deep level dealing with people right near the end of their lives, or a person right near the end of their life, and some people might find that difficult.
Sure.
Final note, the cover was done by our friend W.H. Chong.
Uh-huh. Well, I must look out for that one. It sounds like a tough read, but
I think it is, but I really think that you'd appreciate it. I think that you'll find that it is, it's not that long, probably 200 pages or so, but it's mind-boggling how much is in this in such a short space of time. The prose is spare, but it's just straight to the point. It's just honed beautifully. There's I just read this and go, you wouldn't want to change a sentence of this, not a sentence. That's good.
That sounds good. Yeah, well, Helen Garner is certainly not known for pulling her punches, is she,
for
her fiction.
So be aware that that's the case here too.
Sure. Interesting. All right. Well, mine's a bit of a change of pace from that, but that's all okay. Mine's a book for a young... I wouldn't call it necessarily a young adult novel, but certainly a novel for a younger audience. And this is Metal Fish Falling Snow by Kath Moore. Now, this one... it's won a heap of awards last year. It won the Prime Minister's Literary Award. It won the Victorian Premier's Prize. It won the Griffith University Young Adult Book Award. It was long-listed for the Stella Prize. It got an honourable mention in the CBCA Book of the Year. And, I can see why it did so well, and I like it a lot. And it's obviously a very personal story for the author, who was Kath Moore, who was born in Guyana to Irish and Afro-Caribbean parents, but she was raised in Australia and now lives in Melbourne. And Metal Fish Falling Snow is her first novel, so she's done very well with it as first novel. So like the author, the book's young protagonist is of mixed parentage. Her father comes from Guyana and her mother from France. And she frequently experiences racism because of her dark skin. And you can imagine that the author is drawing from personal experience in that regard. So this first-person protagonist is a girl, young girl called Dylan. She's now 14 years of age, but for whatever reason, she hasn't yet completed the process of puberty. And her mental condition is also a strange mixture of the wayward child and the sophisticated adult. She's often very childish, but nevertheless, she knows a great deal about the world and the ways of grown-ups. She behaves in odd, impulsive ways, and she continually sees the world through a peculiar lens. In fact, she seems to have something like telepathy, in that she often understands what people are thinking, or she experiences dreams as though from another person's point of view. You don't have to accept that as being reality, but it's an interesting sort of tinge to it. So this mix of innocence, mature insight, and secret knowledge often gets her into deep trouble. Now, as the book opens, she's about to set off on a journey with a man called Pat, who's a travelling salesman for a brewing company. And we soon discover that Dylan's mother has recently died and that Pat was her boyfriend. Dylan's father's having abandoned the family some many years ago. So Pat is this really good character. He's a world-weary man addicted to the pokies. But he's as grief-stricken as Dylan at the accidental death of Dylan's mother. And he does his best to protect Dylan and do what he thinks is right for her, despite her frequent provocations, which end up getting him in trouble as well as her. So they set off on this long road journey across rural Australia, heading for the coast. Dylan believes that Pat is taking her to the sea because so they can get her on a boat, on which they'll somehow meet Dylan's mother again and sail off to France to live in Paris. Obviously, this isn't really true, but this is what Dylan believes at the time. And the reader, of course, understands that something else is actually going on. I just really like the book. It handles the serious themes of love, grief, belonging, family ties, and entrenched racism in a solid fashion. Dylan's an intriguing, frequently disturbing young character, and we also develop a lot of sympathy and respect for this character, Pat, despite his obvious flaws and difficulty as a substitute parent. So this was Kath Moore's first book. I'll certainly be looking out for anything else that she chooses to write. That was good.
Okay, that sounds interesting.
Sure. Yeah, it's good. I like reading, reading books for young people.
Yep.
Sometimes they're better than reading the adult books.
Yes, David, we're always of the view that books are for people. That's it. The young adult category, the science fiction genre categories, these are all put on by publishers to help. I look at it from the fact that it's sort of like to help readers find the things that they might be interested in. But we shouldn't get too fixated on it. It sounds to me like sometimes I get too fixated on this as to whether they're in the genre or out, but it's a matter of trying to work out whether people are going to like it. Because of what they've read in the past. And young adult fiction is, as long as it's well written, it's as good as anything else.
Yeah, so absolutely.
That's all or better. Yep. Or better. Yep. Even better, that's right.
Yep.
Now, David, do you remember last year, I think it was, I spoke about a book called The Memory Police by Yoko Ogawa, a Japanese writer, which took a long time to get into an English translation, but finally did. And I was very impressed by that particular book. And I'm now going to talk about an earlier book of that writer's, the book called The Housekeeper and the Professor. And it's interesting to note that this one's also about memory in a certain way, not using the same technique previously about how things were forcibly written out of memory, but this one's just a loss of memory. This one's called The Housekeeper and the Professor from 2003, originally written in Japanese and translated into English. And I should have written down the name of the translator. I really should start doing that, but I haven't done so, so I apologise for that. Now, the professor in this particular title was involved in a car accident. He's a mathematics professor. He was involved in a car accident in 1975, so 17 years prior to the time the novel when the novel is set. So the novel's set in the early 1990s. Now, this car accident has left him with permanent brain damage, and he only has the ability to remember details of the period prior to the accident and on any particular day, only the past 80 minutes of his life. So the housekeeper, who's not named, it's all written in her first person, so we don't really know her name. She's engaged by I think it's the professor's sister-in-law. She's engaged to look after him. The sister-in-law is widowed and lives in a property, and the professor lives in a property right next door. So the sister-in-law engages the housekeeper to come in and look after the house, and look after the professor during the day, to come in the morning after breakfast and then cook him lunch and then cook him dinner and then go home and do the housekeeping and washing and everything else that needs to be done. And so this particular novel follows the period from the time when the housekeeper has been engaged and she starts working there. And over the school, she has actually got a 10-year-old son. And over the holidays, she's decided that because she's, I don't know whether she's a widow or divorced, but anyway, there's no husband around, there's no father of the son around, that she's a single mother having to earn her own money. She can't afford to put the son into childcare, so she takes the son along to the house, saying, you just sit over there and you just be quiet and everything will be fine. And so the professor finds the young boy there and actually takes a bit of a shine to him, really quite likes him. And just continually pat him on the head and looks at him one day and says, oh, I'll have to call you Root. What are you calling me Root for? Oh, the shape of your head looks like a square root. Yeah. It's all flat across the top. And I thought, oh, that's a nice little mathematical joke. So, yeah, so the only character in this particular novel that's got a name is Root, and that is the son.
Okay.
So anyway, so the son keeps coming along and he starts talking to the professor, and the professor decides he's going to start teaching him mathematics. And Root really enjoys this stuff. He thinks it's absolutely fantastic. And he's basically just, that's it really. It's just it's the housekeeper, the professor and the son in terms of their interaction. And then one day the housekeeper convinces the professor, because the professor wanders around. He's got, I don't know whether do you remember the film with Guy Pearce called Memento.
Memento, oh yes, very much so.
So where he basically goes to sleep at night and has forgotten everything from the day before, and he's trying to solve a mystery, so he actually has things tattooed on himself.
Yep.
Well, the professor doesn't go to the extent of tattooing things. He just writes notes for himself and sticks them with pins all over his shirt, his suit, okay. So that he remembers a young boy, Root. So the boy says, oh, that's the young boy, Root. But every day, he turns up and he's forgotten who he is.
Mm.
And so Root's got to say, oh, yes, look, we were doing this yesterday. And the professor goes, oh, yeah, okay, all right. So where are we up to? And Root says, oh, we're up to here. So, okay, so he just starts teaching him from there. Forgotten about what he's taught him before, but he teaches him from there. Oh, you know all of this stuff. Well, that's really good. We can carry on. And it's quite an interesting thing watching this going on. Now, Root's very much a baseball fan, because he's a young Japanese kid, so he likes his baseball. And so does the professor. But the professor only remembers baseball from 1975 and earlier. And so everybody that he remembers, all his favourite players, they were long retired.
Yeah.
And anyway, so they decide that they're going to go off, and the housekeeper decides that, because the son really wants to go to baseball, and it's on one this particular day. It's not far from the house, and so they go down and catch a train and go to the baseball game, and then come back. And sister-in-law is really, really annoyed that this has happened, because she thinks that they should never have taken the professor out. So she sacks the housekeeper. But it all comes back, and everything sort of comes back together again, and somehow or other that they all get back in together, and they basically settle down again into a process of just learning how to live with each other, and it just carries on. And then you just get near the end this idea about where Root is when he's, you know, 10, 15 years further down the track. So he's in his mid-20s and he comes back again. But this is not very much happens in this particular book, but it's a lovely book. It's just a graceful and sensitive discussion about people in adversity living with each other and under very difficult circumstances, where they're just making do and forging a life for themselves and slowly trying to work out what's the best way to work on their way through a particular problem.
Hmm.
Not as good as the memory police, because that was excellent, but this... this is quite worth people's time. Again, it's a shortest novel, again, under 200 pages. But I gave this one 4.0 out of 5. I enjoyed it.
Hmm. That sounds good. It's a fascinating sort of concept, isn't it? Someone who loses their memory after only, 40 minutes or something like that?
80 minutes.
80 minutes, yeah, that's right. It reminds me of a number of articles by Oliver Sacks, if you've read his works. And some
Awakenings
of the patients,
and things like that. Yeah.
And the man who mistook his wife for a hat, that sort of thing. Mm. And there's a lot of case studies he discusses which are sort of similar to that. And fascinating. So, and as you say, that film Memento, which is brilliant, meaning to go back and watch it again. I've only seen it once.
Nolan, that's right. That's
Christopher Nolan,
who later went on to do The Prestige, which is also based on the Christopher Priest novel. That's also an excellent film.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he did the major Dark Knight Batman trilogy, which included Heath Ledger's Joker. So he did very, very well there. I think he's probably lost his way a little bit since then.
Recent film Tenet didn't seem to go too well. Tenet?
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
No, I haven't seen it either.
Inception was okay, but I mean a little bit. Anyway, don't dislike it. But anyway, so Memento was fantastic.
I must watch that again.
This one's a nice little story.
Jolly good. All right, well, I'll move on to my next one, which is again a book for younger people. And I read this purely because when Perry was talking to Lucy Sussex, our friend Lucy, a little while ago on the podcast, she mentioned a number of books by this author which sounded very intriguing. And so I just happened to find this one at the library. And so the author is Frances Hardinge, H-A-R-D-I-N-G, and the book is called Deep Light. And it's good, I enjoyed it, but it took me quite a while to get through the book because it seems extraordinarily long for a book which is intended for a younger audience. I'm assuming it's sort of middle grade sort of level it's aimed at, has that sort of feel. But in the paperback edition I read, it runs to 432 pages, a quite small type. It must be at least 120,000 words, which is pretty long. Mind you, I suppose Harry Potter, the longer Harry Potter books are about that sort of length. But nevertheless, I thought it was a bit long for a book for that kind of audience. I mean, I'm no stranger to reading long books. I mean, after all, I read Samuel Richardson's Clarissa, which is one of the longest books in the English language. I'm also very fond of the work of Neal Stephenson, who's can be very long-winded. But I think the thing is, if you're having trouble getting into a story, and you can see as you hold the book in your hand that there's a lot more of it to go, it can be a bit of a challenge to sort of keep going. And that was the case here. Deep Light did take a while to engage my interest. Maybe that's just me. Anyway, once it did get going, I did enjoy it. But it just took a little while to get into. It certainly has a very clever concept. It's set on a group of small islands called the Myriads. Now, in the Myriads or around the Myriads, once in the past, there were monstrous gods dwelling in the ocean. And these gods emerged from time to time to devastate human communities. But decades before, however, there was a battle between all of these gods, and they were all wiped out. So this is only several decades before the action of the story. And now, in the present day in the story, humans descend in crude submarines and diving bells and things like that to hunt for pieces of the bodies of these gods, these monsters, which may have valuable and magical properties. So the book follows the story of young Hark, who is under the influence of a somewhat older boy, Jelt, who constantly leads poor Hark into trouble. But getting into trouble, serious trouble on the Myriads, generally means becoming enslaved and put up for auction, which is what happens to Hark. Now, his new owner brings him to an island which hosts the Sanctuary, which is a kind of aged care facility for old priests who, of course, were out of a job when all the gods died. And so Gelt continues to get Hark into trouble. He travels to the sanctuary to contact Hark secretly, and together they venture underwater in a stolen submersible. Beneath the waves, Hark finds a perilous object, the heart of one of the gods. And this object, Hark discovers, has miraculous healing powers, which he needs because Gelt, on this voyage, essentially drowns, and Hark has to sort of bring him back to life with this magical object. But the heart also changes those that it heals, and not necessarily for the better. The story becomes too complex to summarize further, but one noteworthy feature of the book, which is really interesting, I thought, was the inclusion of several deaf characters. And those people who have descended too many times into the undersea tend to lose their hearing completely. And one such young character who plays an important role in the book is Selfin, who's the daughter of a chief of an illicit salvage gang, and she's totally deaf. So the author's dealing with deafness is very sympathetic and well-informed throughout. In fact, apparently the reason that she introduced this character and the whole concept of deafness into the book was one of her readers, young readers, contacted the author and said, "Why don't you ever include a deaf character?" So she started thinking, and here we are with a major part of the book being about deafness and communication when you're deaf. And so, though I was a bit daunted by the length of the book at the start and the time it took me to get engaged in the story, that definitely has promise, I think. And I'm going to be looking up some of the other titles that she's written. She's written several books, and from what Lucy was saying, they all sound to have quite intriguing premises. So I will keep going, but so for some reason, might just have been me, it just took me a while to get into. There you go.
Yeah, fair enough. That's good. Yes, it is an interesting thing about having more characters, more deaf characters, like more blind characters, more characters with disabilities. I mean, Emma Visage has got a major character with who's deaf. And I went to see just recently a very, very good, very long, over 3-hour film called Drive My Car, Japanese. It was nominated. It was one of the finalists for the Oscar for Best Film, and actually won the Oscar for Best International Film. And one of the major characters in the second or the last half of the film isn't deaf, but is mute, so can't speak, and uses sign language. And the way that it's handled, the communication there, is just fantastic. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Well, it's a long film, and I would I'd heartily recommend seeing it. But if you can see it on a streaming service, it'll be good because you'll be okay. You won't need to worry about the volume because, of course, it's all got subtitles.
Yeah.
But you can have a break halfway through. I went along to see it with a friend, and we were the only two in the audience.
The cinema was
completely empty, bar for the two of us.
Good, for staying away from the bug anyway.
And so, two-thirds of the way through, we started to discuss the film because we realised that we could talk as much as we wanted, but it wasn't really going to impact anybody else.
Very good,
And so that was interesting. And, you could say, that was good. Oh, look at that. Didn't see that. So that was interesting.
Yeah, that's based on a short story by Haruki Murakami, who's one of my favourite authors. So I haven't read the story, but I must both read the story and see the film.
It has been adapted, but you'd think you'd be struggling, wouldn't you, to move from a short story to a three-hour movie.
Yeah.
And people complain about movies being too long. I didn't find this too long at all. It just kept my interest the whole way through. Yes, a lot of it's long and slow, and there's a lot of talking and a lot. I didn't care. It was just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And yet you can go and see a film that lasts for an hour and a half and think, why did I waste my time? It should have been half the length. It's just odd that some people just know how to handle things of a long film, and some people just have no idea. Right, now, so David, I'm going to move on to something slightly different here, because in the second half of this particular episode, I'm going to be dealing with a number of science fiction and fantasy novellas from 2021. In fact, I'm going to be looking at 8 of them in 2 batches. Now, I normally do this, I'll have a look at a lot of novellas about this time of year because the Nebula Award ballot and the Hugo Award ballots are both out, and they have both have a novella category. Mostly, there's a lot of crossover between those two. But this year, it's slightly different. There are only 2 novellas that appear on both ballots. Interesting enough. Anyway, so let's go back to definitions again in case people have forgotten. Now, novella is a piece of shorter fiction, so shorter than a novel, that lies in the range of 17,500 to 40,000 words. So somewhere between 60 and 120 pages. A lot of times being called, a lot of times they were called short novels. If you remember back to the Ace Doubles, that basically went back to back, two stories back to back with the covers upside down, and you could turn them around. They were mostly short novels or novellas, so they fitted that. I really like the novella length because it gives you enough time to get an idea about whether the author, it gives enough time for the author to show their chops. You can work out whether they can handle a plot, whether they can handle character, whether they can handle the actual writing process, and you get an idea of what they're actually interested in. And so coming across new authors, you don't have to go, oh God, is a 600-page brick that I have to work my way through? Oh, look, over here they've got a novella. Let's read that and see what that sort of author's like. So you can get an idea of what the author does before you dive headfirst into the deep end of the pool. That's always a good thing. Now, we're going to be looking at the stories that have been nominated on the Hugo Award ballot coming up in episodes later on in the year. We have I've got a fair bit of reading to do. You're going to be doing some of it, but not all of it. But I'll be going through all of the novellas, for example. So what I'm going to be doing now is I'm going to be talking about novellas that are from 2021, but which are not on the Hugo ballot, because I want to do all the Hugo ballots together. Now, this means that of the, I think it's 7 stories that are on the novella ballot for the Nebula, I'm only going to be dealing with 5 of them. But you'll get the rest of them later on, but you get a bit of an idea about what sort of stuff is around at the novella length. But just to give you, just to tell you what sort of stuff's here, the works on the ballot for the Hugo Award for Best Novella are A Psalm for the Wild Built. I always was calling this Well Built, but no, it's not. A Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers. That's on the Nebula Award ballot. Fireheart Tiger by Elliot de Bodard, which is also on the Nebula ballot, and which won the BSFA Award for Best Shorter Fiction over the weekend. A Spindle Splintered by Alex E. Harrow. Across the Green Grass Fields by Shaunan Maguire. That's one of her Wayward Children stories. Elder Race by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And The Past is Red by Catherine M. Valente. Interesting that these are the ones that are on the Hugo ballot. Interesting that all 6 were published by Tor.com. This is the same as what happened in 2021. As I said last year, I didn't think that was a good situation. I think it's even getting a little bit worse now that people are only picking up Tor.com novellas. Now, I'm quite happy that Tor is doing a lot of novellas and doing a lot of good stuff. But I'd really like to see other publishers, either publishers or magazines, being represented on the Hugo ballot. It's a bit of a problem, I think. Things are a little bit different with the Nebula Award, but we'll get to that a little bit later on in the second part of this. But first I wanted to talk about 3 particular novellas that I think are worthy of people's attention that didn't make either list. The first of these is Light Chaser by Peter F. Hamilton and Gareth Powell, again from Tor.com. Peter Hamilton writes big, massive space opera novels, and Gareth Powell writes space opera novels slightly smaller than that. This was nominated for the 2022 BSFA Award for Best Shorter Fiction, but didn't win because Fireheart Tiger did. Now, basically, if you're looking for a galaxy-spanning, massive time-span space opera, then you'd be hard-pressed to go past this particular one.
Oh, God.
No, I like those. I like them. Don't diss it straight away. The light chaser of this particular title is Amahle, spelled A-M-A-H-L-N-A-L-E, who is a genetically altered and almost immortal human female. And she's the captain and sole human occupant of the starship Nemesine. It was obviously named after the Greek goddess of memory. And that makes a that's important here. Now, her role is to continually travel between the human population planets of the Domain, which is strung across the galaxy. So the Domain is just the name of all the sort of human-like planets that are across the galaxy. And she travels at close to the speed of light, stopping off to distribute new and collect old memory collars. Now, these are life experience recording devices that her employers collect from her and sell for entertainment. So these, she drops them off at one particular visit. Next time she comes back, it's like 70, 80 years later, and she picks them up again. They've been passed down from father to son to daughter or mother to son to daughter. And it's really, it's considered to be an honour to basically have one of these and for her to drop by and pick them up. Now, between the worlds, there's a bit of a gap between the worlds, as you can imagine, that even though they're travelling at the speed of light, that she does have to spend a bit of time just sitting there waiting to get to the next destination. Amahle also likes to listen in and sample the collars as she goes because she just, you know, likes to keep herself entertained. And on one particular voyage, she comes across a 1,000-year-old message that seems to have been left to her from a various planet from someone called Carloman, telling her not to trust the artificial intelligence controlling her ship. It's quite interesting. She's sitting there listening in, and this woman's sitting in a bar, and this guy walks up to her and said, "I see you've got one of those memory collars. Right, here's a message for Amahle. Don't trust the AI on your ship," and just walks off. Bit odd, she thinks. She's getting pretty intrigued by this. Firstly, that somebody's going to leave a message for her. But what the hell's the point in that? How does he know who I am, and how does he know that this is the case, and how is this possibly going to have any impact? But she gets a bit intrigued and starts looking around, starts finding more and more messages from this particular person from lots of different planets. So it leads her into a mystery concerning her own life and the future of the human race in space. This is basic space opera with a human touch. And what's not to like about that, David? Not to like. I gave it 4.0 out of 5.
Oh, jolly good.
Jolly good. Now, next one, Remote Control by Nnedi Okorafor, published by Tor.com. Can't get away from it. It really just can't, which is rather unfortunate. So this one, Nnedi Okorafor sprang to prominence a few years back with a series of novellas featuring her character Binti, the first of which I thought was excellent. A couple of the others not quite so good, but overall, quite an interesting series of novellas. And that's if you want to know where science fiction's been going the last 5 or so years, I would hardly recommend that you read Binti. It's one of those ones that is in should be on your to be read list. This one not so much, but it's still worthy of being looked at. This is set in near future Ghana, where a young woman named Fatima spends a day sitting in a favourite tree, staring at the sky and the stars. Now, one day, a strange green light falls on her in a town just from out of the sky. And later she finds a small wooden box at the base of a tree, and inside the box is a seed. Now, she decides she wants to keep this box and keep this particular seed, but sometime later her father sells the box to an unscrupulous politician because basically he feels as though they need the money. And shortly thereafter, a power starts growing inside Fatima that kills all the inhabitants of her village, including her family. She just radiates this power and just kills everybody. Now, she wakes up from this episode with no memory of her own names, so she then adopts the title Sankova, which possibly has some connotation, which I don't know what it is. But she also now has the power to kill at will, so she can kill whatever she wants. So, you know, she learns by killing fleas and that sort of stuff, killing mosquitoes everywhere. And so then she just basically starts walking across Ghana, trying to get this box of hers back again. So this is a coming-of-age story as it follows Senkova up into her teenage years, helping people when she can, because if she can kill at will, then she can help people pass from a state of absolute distress into death easily, because the method she uses is painless and basically just people go to sleep and don't wake up. So she's basically called in to help with acts of euthanasia. And she continues to search for this missing box. But of course, all the time, she's got this burden of death walking with her all the time. But she always remains in charge of her own destiny in her life. This is an interesting story, but it doesn't really do much and offer much anything really new. Akora 4 is worthwhile reading. This one's not her best. I gave it 3.2 out of 5, but, you know, worthwhile looking at.
Mm-hmm.
The last one I'm going to talk about in this particular section is Fugitive Telemetry by Martha Wells. Now, we mentioned last time when the Nebula Award came out, I noted that on the Nebula ballot that this one didn't appear, and I thought that it should have, only for us to find out later on that Martha Wells had declined the nomination. It's quite possible for you to do that. Same thing happens with the Hugo Awards and the Nebula Awards, that the administrators get in contact with the people that have got the most nominations and ask if they would like to appear on the ballot. It's quite reasonable for you to be able to say, no, I don't. The administrators never reveal who does and who does not want to appear on the ballot. Oh, well, if they do want to appear on the ballot, you know who they are, because there they are. But they don't reveal anybody that has declined the offer of the nomination. But Martha Wells revealed that she had decided that she didn't want to be nominated in this instance. And the fact that she's not on the Hugo ballot makes me wonder whether she also declined that as well. But we probably won't know that until Martha Wells herself makes it be known, or after the end of the balloting, the votes. Once the awards are handed out, then the administrators may well then say, because they give details of the nomination votes, so they will have to point out that Martha Wells declined the offer to appear on the ballot. Anyway, so this is number 6 in the author's Murderbot series, and it's the 5th novella. She did very well last year, of course, because she won the Best Novel and the Best Series Hugo Awards for this particular series of stories. And, yeah, I really like these. I enjoy them a lot. In this instance, the Murderbot is asked to investigate the death of an unidentified traveller on the preservation station, but that's against the wish of the station's security unit. And so the Murderbot's disallowed the access to the station's systems and memory banks and basically has to set out and rely on good old-fashioned detective work to find a solution. And so it, because it is an it, has to work on a lot of legwork. It discovers the location of the original murder, which wasn't where the body was found, works out the method used to move the body and a possible set of suspects. Like all good murder investigations, of course, initial suspicions are generally just that and are generally wrong. And Murderbot finds itself having to rely on human help and also talking to them, neither of which it particularly likes, but which it has to use in order to find a solution, which it does. Enjoyable, another good entry in the series. Not at the top level, but worth 4.0 out of 5, I think. And that does me for this part of the novellas. I'll be back a bit later on.
We'll come back.
Finish off.
Well, I will talk about another book then. And this is my last book. And this is Stone Sky Gold Mountain by Miranda Riwo. I'm not sure how you pronounce this name at all. R-I-W-O-E Riwo? Don't know. Anyway, and again, this, like the previous book I talked about, this has won several awards. It won the 2020 Queensland Literary Award. Won in the fiction category. It won the inaugural ARA Historical Novel Prize. ARA is the Australian... No, I can't tell you what it is. ARA, anyway, is Historical Novel Prize. It was shortlisted for the 2021 Stella Prize and longlisted for the 2021 Miles Franklin Literary Award. So, what's it about? Well, it's a historical novel, I should expect from winning a Historical Novel Prize. Historical novel... set in northern Queensland in 1877, and it follows the fortunes of a teenage brother and sister who have travelled to Australia from Hong Kong in search of their fortunes on the gold fields. Now, they've left behind their mother and father and several of their siblings, some of whom have been sold by the family to help repay their father's gambling debts. So they've travelled to Australia to try and get enough money to completely free their father from his debts. But life on the goldfield is very hard and gold is scarce. And the Chinese are continually harassed and racially abused by the white miners. And they're subject to arbitrary raids that check the miners' licenses. And if they don't have them, they're arrested and put in chains. Now, the sister of the two, the sister Mi Ying, has disguised herself as a boy to avoid attracting attention from the men on the goldfield, and she maintains this disguise even when she and her brother, Lei Yu, leave the goldfield and travel to a nearby town to seek different work after they give up on trying to find enough gold. Now, her brother, Lei Yu, is a really tormented young man. He's consumed with this responsibility as the eldest child of the family to recover the family's fortunes. And he also believes that he's visited by the spirit of his betrothed, Shan, who drowned in a flood before they could marry. And the imaginary voice of Shan is constantly critical of Yu, denigrating him and destroying any sense of self-esteem, which is further eroded by the attitude of the whites with whom he's forced to associate, of course. Ying, on the other hand, settles down well into a job in a store owned by a Chinese man in the town. And here Ying, still pretending to be a young man, comes in contact with Miriam, who's a young white woman, who's also treated as a despised outcast by most of the town because she works as the housekeeper for the local prostitute. Against all odds and the lack of a common language, a deep affection grows up between this unlikely pair, Ying and Miriam. Now, when Miriam's mistress is violently attacked one night and left, on the brink of death, suspicion immediately falls on the Chinese community, and in particular on Ying, who had been visiting Miriam and someone who'd seen Ying leave the place late at night. Of course, everyone still thinks that Ying is male, and so Ying is now a prime suspect. Look, this is a really interesting, very well-described depiction of life on the goldfields from the point of view of the Chinese immigrants and details how they were scorned and abused by the whites and yet managed to survive by supporting each other as a community. Overall, it's not a cheerful book. Several reviewers describe it as heartbreaking, which I guess it is. Certainly, poor Lei Yu is... It really comes down in the world and eventually is led into complete despair. So, yeah, it's not cheerful. But nevertheless, despite that, the very end of the book ends on a hopeful note. So, yeah, I was very glad I read this. I really enjoyed it. And, that's a good book. Certainly, if you're interested in that sort of period of history and interested in how the Chinese coped in Australia, it's well worth reading.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Does it give you a definitive location for the goldfields that they were in?
It does. I'm trying to see. It does actually mention a particular town. It says it's set in northern Queensland. I've forgotten the name of the town, I'm afraid, and I don't have the book anymore to check. But, the author does mention a particular location.
Okay.
Because I don't normally think of Queensland as a place where there were goldfields.
But no, but there's goldfields everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. But
all over.
They were. Yeah.
Yeah, they were everywhere. So. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm here to finish off, and I'm talking about the rest of the SF and fantasy novellas for 2021. This is part two of my tirade, if you like. Not so much a tirade.
Dissertation. Your dissertation.
There. Mm. And I'm going to be talking here about the novellas that are on the 2022 Nebula Award ballot, leaving out, of course, those stories which are also nominated for the Hugo Award. So I'll give you the list of the novellas first that are on the ballot. A Psalm for the Wild Built, almost did it. Psalm for the Wild Built by Becky Chambers, which is on the Hugo ballot. Fireheart Tiger by Elliot de Bodard, which is also on the Hugo ballot. And what can we offer you tonight by Premi Mohammed? The first novella we're talking about today, not published by Tor.com. This is from a publishing house called Neon Hemlock. Sun Daughters, Sea Daughters by Amy Ogden, another Tor. Flowers for the Sea by Zin E. Rocklin, another Tor novella. The Necessity of Stars by E. Catherine Tobler from Neon Hemlock. And the one and only novella published in any either print or online magazine on the two major ballots. This one is The Giants of the Violet Sea by Eugenia Trienta Filao from Uncanny Magazine, September-October 2021. Now, there are, 7 on this particular ballot. There would normally be five or six on the Nebula ballot. As I said, Martha Wells declined to be included as a finalist here. And because of that, they then go down to the next novella, and there were two that had exactly the same number of votes. So they both go on. Which of those? We don't know. I don't know whether the Nebula Awards release their nominations to quite nomination statistics to quite the extent that the Hugo Award administrators do. Must keep an eye on that sometime, see what happens. So the first one we're going to talk about is What Can We Offer You Tonight by Premi Mohammed. This is a new author for me. She had two... They had two novellas out last year that have received a bit of impact, the other being The Annual Migration of Clouds, which sounds like an intriguing title and which I might go and have a bit of a look at. Anyway, main character of this one, Jewel, works at the house Bicchieri, which is one of the classiest brothels in a far future city. Now, when Jill's friend Winfred wakes up after her own funeral, she hardly seems to be put out at all. So Winfred's come back like a zombie and decides that she's going to find the man who murdered her and gets Jill's support in this particular endeavour, as you do. I mean, when your friend comes back from the dead, says, I want to find out who killed me. Yeah,
of course you would.
Well, of course you would. And you think, right, well, actually, that sounds interesting. But the story here is more about Jules in a turmoil and attempts to keep the job she hates rather than the murder investigation. It's a bit weird. So this novella promises more than it delivers, although it is evocative and beautifully written. And maybe if it had been a tad longer, it might have been able to integrate the two main parts of the story into something more rounded. It just left me wanting something else. I mean, I got bits on one side, didn't get enough of the other one, and the murder mystery gets solved. And, how did that happen? So I gave this one 3.2 out of 5. It wasn't as good as I was hoping that it would be.
Okay.
Next one, Sun Daughters, Sea Daughters by Amy Ogden, another tour.com. This is a science fictional retelling of the Little Mermaid story, basically. Atual, I think that's probably how you pronounce it, A-T-U-A-L-E, was a mermaid, or maybe a selkie. It isn't really clear which one they were. But she's turned her back on the life in the sea on the planet of Maravan. 15 years later, her husband, Saraval, and his whole clan have been stricken with a virus that has proven to be 100% fatal. It takes some time, but it's proven to be 100% fatal. And in order to save her husband, Atuel turns to the World Witch, who's a former lover, for help in finding a cure. Now, the World Witch was female and has now had implants and has now transitioned to being a male. The two of them get together and decide that really the only way to find a cure is to go to another technologically advanced planet and see whether they'll be able to help. So after a journey across the galaxy through all these jump stations, they finally arrive at a place that may be able to help them. But they first off have to get through the quarantine regulations because the planet on which they've come from, well, it's got a virus on it. And as we know, when you have viruses, you have to go through quarantine. And, so they try and jump that and then get themselves into trouble over that. And then get some help from some really strange aliens. So this is a very predictable story, which has the basic plot and world-being elements for a reasonable piece of fiction. But the whole thing just seems to be too rushed with too little tension and no drama. It's just, again, it's just everything just go bang, 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 just too quick.
Mm.
It's not often that I wish a story was longer, but I do in this case. And I think that the need for it is really rather obvious. It just needs, things just happen too fast. And you get anything, what? So I only gave this one 3.1 out of 5. It's, you know, it's almost there, but it's not there. This is something that I found a bit with this. A lot of the novellas this year were really quite short, 60 or 80 pages, whereas the last few years, they've more been 100 and, you know, pushing the upper limits.
Mm.
So I don't know what's gone on here. I really don't. Anyway, next one's Flowers for the Sea by Zin E. Rocklin. This is a debut novella and features a group of survivors from a flooded kingdom who now live on an ark at sea, surrounded by fearsome creatures which harass them by day and by night. So they have to spend a lot of their time below decks. The main character here, Iraxi, is pregnant with a child that might be something more than human. But will it be a monster, or will it be the saviour of this group of survivors? Now, Iraxi in the past has been ostracised from her community for refusing a marriage offer from a prince, which a lot of people thought might have helped them get along, but she didn't like him, and that was it. She just decided not to. But she's part of the survivors, and now she has to contend with scarce food and resources, also the enmity and open hatred of her fellow travellers, and the difficulties of her pregnancy and her birth. And the birth, not her birth, the birth. This is a dark, disturbing fantasy, which has had an impact, which also seems only half-formed. It's just not enough here to really get to grips with. It seems to concentrate purely and simply on the visceral side of the birth, and they actually give you a warning about, you know, birth stuff at front, which is okay. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. But that's only just part of the story. It's the whole thing doesn't, you know, this really reads like it's going to be expanded into a novel at some time in the future. And so really it doesn't come together for me. And frankly, I don't really think I'm going to be terribly interested in reading the novel when it comes out. I only gave this one 2.8 out of 5. Wasn't really keen on this one much at all.
Okay.
The next is The Necessity of Stars by E. Catherine Tobler, again from Neon Hemlock, the other small publishing house that's produced this. It's set on Earth in 2148, and Brioni Hemerly is the special representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations, or has been. She sort of still is. She's sort of semi-retired and is living on a United property called Iris Lands in Normandy, France. And, of course, climate change has affected everything and things are all a bit weird. And then the next house, it seems to be sort of almost like a gated community run by the UN. And the next house lives a long-term friend, Delphine Chevridi. Earth has been ravaged by climate change, as I said, to the extent that most of it is becoming uninhabitable. But this small section of France appears to be surviving remarkably well. It seems to have just warmed up just enough. I mean, with climate change, there are going to be places on Earth which are actually going to be pretty good, but they're going to be few and far between.
That's right, and crowded.
And there's going to be a lot of people going to want to get there. Yeah. And so the United Nations has grabbed this particular thing. So now, the reason why this particular area might be going really quite well is it might be because of the alien that Brioni discovers in her garden one day. She's down there, sees something move and goes back to moving again, and then, but is it there? Is it there? She can't be sure that what she's seen is about what she's seen. She's suffering from ongoing dementia, losing her short-term memory, and is sometimes unable to differentiate between reality and dreaming. And so this is a story about a silent alien invasion. Where is it? The usefulness of older people, because the UN representative, the UN Secretary in General comes to get these two women to help solve a particular international problem. And also about the role of friendship and love in later years as people move on down their lives. Now, Tobler writes in an interesting atmospheric style here, which perfectly suits the story, though the ending is a tad problematic. I don't think it sort of comes together terribly well. She's a quite prolific story with about 120 short SF pieces published since 2000. I don't think I've read anything by her. Maybe I have, but, you know, I don't recall reading it, but I better start finding out because she's got a bit of talent here. And I gave this one 4.0 out of 5.
Okay.
So our last one, The Giants of the Violet Sea. by Eugenia Trieta Filao, which is from Uncanny magazine, September-October 2021. So at some time in the past, the distant planet of Leth, L-E-T-H-E, was colonised by people from Earth's Mediterranean region, and they brought with them vines and fig and olive trees, as you would.
Mm-hmm.
They also brought dolphins with them, which is a bit strange. And these dolphins have adapted to the new environment and evolved in this new ocean of this particular planet. And now they're referred to as Veni dolphins. I'm not sure why they've done that. But they have a sack of poisonous ink which grows out of the nervous system at the top of their heads that they use to stun their fish prey. But sometime in the past, somebody's discovered that the ink in these sacks is also a powerful drug. So, which is prized on many planets and, you know, it's quite addictive. And so these particular Veni dolphins are being hunted by poachers who extract the sacks and in the process kill the creatures. The main character of this story, Themis, returns to a sea community from the city after the death of her brother, Melas, to help her mother prepare for his funeral. But she discovers that it was not killed in an accident, it was originally thought, but actually murdered, probably because he was trying to stop and uncover the poachers and stop them, stop their trade. And so she believes that they may have killed him. So Themis sets out to solve the murder, helped by Melissa's best friend and the alien Clem, who seems to be more of a human person that's come to check out what's going on the planet, doesn't really like the atmosphere very much and always has to wander around in a spacesuit, but, you know, he's there to, and then he basically is also doing an ecological survey, so he's keen on working out what's happening with the dolphins, and so he's trying to work out who's doing what. The resolution of this murder is pretty obvious fairly quickly, and so you don't really feel as though there's much of a mystery here. But the strength, so it loses a bit because of that. But the strength of the story lies in the world building and the journey Themis makes as she integrates into her old community. I would have liked to have seen a bit more on the murder mystery and that have been handled better, and I would have given it higher than my 3.8 out of 5. It had the opportunity to be probably the best of the ones that are here, but doesn't quite make it because the murder mystery is a major part of this particular novella and it just doesn't hang together that well. It's not handled that well.
Yeah.
So that's the that's those. So there are, was it 8 novellas that I've discussed there? There will be another 5 or 6 coming up when later in the year when I do the Hugo novellas. I've got I've read 3 of them. I've got 3 more to go. So,
oh, you're well on the way.
Oh, well on the way. But it's look. As I said, I find it interesting to see where things are going. There's a lot more. There's a lot more stories by women writers that are being nominated. And so there are a lot more female characters, main characters coming through. It's interesting also to see that Light Chaser, the one by that I told you was written by Hamilton and Powell, also has a female main character. And I think it just means that, well, the field's changing, David.
Sure.
We know that. And is it changing for the better?
Well,
sometimes you
change is generally a good thing.
A change is a good thing. I mean, we may be changing topics, we may be changing our emphasis on the characters, but it still has to be a good story.
Oh yeah.
And I think that as we've been going through the Hugo time machine, as you'll know, we'll come across some years where you'll get 3 or 4 absolute crackers that are just tremendous, and you think these will stand the test of time, and then you get another year where they're all like, you know, that is meh, you know, there's nothing here. So I don't believe that the overall quality going higher or lower is going higher or lower. It's just different subject matter that has been dealt with in the stories, occasionally you'll still come across one where you think, this is really well done and really good.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter what the subject matter is. It's the story that counts.
Hmm.
Whereas, but in general, the bulk of the stories that you come across are going to be sort of like okay, but mostly forgettable. What we're looking for are the ones that go, yep, that's going to stay with me. I'm going to remember that story for a long time. They're the ones we're looking for. None of them here really stood out tremendously. I did like Light Chaser, but then I do like space operas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty good. So let's hope that we can find something really good in the Hugo novellas when we talk about them a bit later.
Indeed. Sounds good. All right. Well, we probably had enough talking for this episode. And we'll be back in 3 weeks' time, which, according to my calculation, means we'll be out on the 10th of May.
Yeah,
we'll be recording the day before, but we'll be out on the 10th of May.
We're a day late this time because of the Easter break. We didn't want to do it on Easter Monday, so we're doing this on the day later and coming out a day later. And next time, I think we're back dealing with crime novels.
Crime. I better read a few.
Well, crime, because there's one particular book that I'm going to be talking about, which is not a novel, but it's about crime.
Oh, fair enough.
And hopefully that will be of interest to you, David.
It sounds good. Sounds good.
All right. Yeah. All right. Okay. We'll see you then.
See you, David.
Bye.
Bye.